death and taxes, two certainties in life. Well, let's address that second one as April 15th approaches. While paying taxes can't be legally avoided, how much you pay Uncle Sam depends on what the current structure of the tax code is. With an election for president and Congress coming up in November, who wins at both those levels of government will certainly be the ones obviously determining how much you'll wind up paying. Joining us now to examine what the two men at the top of their respective political parties who are running for president have as their priorities is a former attorney and advisor for the U.S. Treasury's Office of Tax Legislative Counsel. He's also author of the book, From Ronald to Donald, How the Myth of Reagan Became the Cult of Trump. Ed Oswald, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing great, Chris. Pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
Well, good to talk with you in for two reasons. First, for better understanding of taxes, and second, for really, as I said to Ed before we started here, whether you're pro or anti-Reagan, certainly a well-told story of who the man was, not just his policies. We'll get to that shortly. EdwinGOswald.com is Mr. Oswald's website. We have that linked at our homepage. So, as I said, election time coming, and tax is always one of the top issues that the voters are focusing on. The image has always been Democrats bad for taxes, Republicans good for taxes. Has that always been held up in history, and what are we looking at in the here and now as far as President Biden and President Trump's sense of priorities?
Well, thank you, Chris. You know, historically, if you go back really pre-Reagan, there were not significant differences in terms of tax rates and tax policies between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. I know you have to reach back somewhat more than four decades to appreciate that, but there was not the stark difference that we see today. But dealing with the present situation, Chris, there's quite a contrast, I think, now in terms of tax policy and both the upcoming election and also the expiration of Trump's tax cut bill in 2017, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Those tax cut provisions expire next year, December 31st. So I expect 2025 to be tax policy and tax rates to be front and center as Congress and the executive branch deal with both the deficit as well as the expiring tax provisions of Trump's tax bill.
Or as we've seen the current climate in Congress, it really depends on who's running both the House and the Senate as far as any kind of cooperation and mutual understanding of getting things done will come into play, or will it just continue to be the stalemate that we've seen?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think, to say it simply, if Biden wins and he controls the House and Senate, I think we could expect tax rates to go up. In Biden's budget proposal for fiscal year 25, he's proposing raising corporate tax rates, which are different than Trump's tax cut bill. Biden has proposed a minimum tax on billionaires. And, Chris, I'm not sure if that's based on income or wealth. The details are we don't quite know yet. But Biden is also the current U.S. budget deficit is $34 trillion. Yes, trillion with a T. And I think Biden is also looking to manage the deficit and pay something down. Conversely, if Trump wins and he takes the House and Senate with him, I think we can expect to see further tax cuts. I think that many of the tax cuts implemented by his 2017 Tax Act will be made permanent, and it'll be a very different tax profile depending on which man might win and also whether he takes the Congress and Senate with him. To your last point, if either Trump or Biden wins, but they don't control both the House and Senate, then I think we're perhaps more in a stalemate situation where there's ultimately a grand compromise, but the tax needle does not shift significantly.
What I saw of the Biden tax plan, according at least to the budget requests, which are always written in pencil, as we well know,
yes,
he's focusing more on corporate taxes and the billionaires. And this made me think back. This might be a weird point to include over the analogy, but I remember there was a biography of the comedy team Abbott and Costello, and this was back in the day when the top earners were paying 90% tax rates, and they had their accountant messed up, and they had to basically sell everything, but Abbott wound up living in a small apartment in Southern California. It's hasn't been that hard on the corporations and the rich. I mean, it was 70% during the Nixon era. Reagan brought it down to 28%. Is it a damaging thing for either the economy or the business climate if that corporate rate went back into the 30 percentile at some level?
You know, I don't really think so. Right now it's 21, and you're right. It may move back to 28, or at least that's what Biden has proposed. But I don't think it'll be damaging to the economy, and frankly. And also, as you noted, historically, the tax rates in the United States have been much higher. Under Nixon, it was 70% or better. Under Eisenhower, it was actually north of 90. Under JFK, it was again 90. In the words of Joe Biden, historically, the rich in the United States have paid their fair share. All of that really changed with the election of Ronald Reagan and the implementation of his tax policies. And there are very good studies at this point that show that there's really a direct correlation between income to the top and tax cuts for the wealthy. And I do believe, personally at least, that if we had higher tax rates for the wealthy, there'd be less of a wealth and income gap in the United States, and frankly, we'd be all better off.
And as you mentioned, too, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, that let people keep more of their money. So in turn, they got smaller refunds, which if you're narrow-sighted, you looked at that as something bad. But, you know, it's basically you not loaning the government your money at no interest until April 15th comes along. But but if you're irresponsible with money, and if there's a poor business climate around, no matter how much money you have in your pocket, well, things aren't going to be as rosy as you would hope they would be.
I mean, that's true. I mean, really, we're all, if you will, in this boat together. And the lower tiers within the income structure have disposable income because less national income goes to the top. All of us prosper. As JFK, I think, once said, if in a free society, if we cannot help the many who are poor, we cannot save the few who are rich. And in the book, Ronald to Donald, we go out of the way to make that case that that you can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have a thriving, safe democracy and a body of the population that consume your goods, then you're no better off with tax rates being very low for your particular income spectrum because your business won't prosper.
And certainly we know now as fact, it can't be denied, and by no matter how much you want to try to twist the numbers, trickle-down economics did not work and cannot work. It just doesn't. A plan can't rely on assumptions for it to succeed.
You know, very well said, and it's really a paradox, a puzzle. It doesn't really make much sense. The notion of trickle down economics or Reaganomics, it's been around for more than 40 years now, and is still really part of the brand of the GOP. But tax cuts don't pay for themselves. You know, every tax cut costs money. The economy does not grow in a manner that's sufficient to cover the loss from that tax cut. You know, period, full stop. You can look at more than, I'll say, two dozen studies out there on that point. And what we've been really in a cycle here of, deficit spending for more than 40 years. None of the tax cuts, whether it be Reagan's in 81 or 86 or Bush's in 2001 or Trump's in 2017 have paid for themselves. They've all added to the deficit. The interest on the deficit now, believe it or not, Chris, is $870 billion this year just to cover the debt service on the $34 trillion. So in many ways, we're going to have to face up to this. We're going to have to start paying our bills. And as Biden has alluded to, tax rates will ultimately have to go up.
The debt service, by the way, if you're listening, is approaching, and maybe at this point that we're talking about, maybe has surpassed what is currently being spent annually on a U.S. military, just as a point of reference. I want to wrap up with your book, From Ronald to Donald, because, as I said, if you are pro-Reagan, anti-Reagan, it's important to understand the man through facts and personal experience, and that maybe leads you to a better understanding, might even change your opinion of who the person is. And you did that with getting into the life of Reagan, not just his policies. What was it about Reagan that connected?
Yeah, no, thank you. I came of age politically during the Carter-Reagan years, the debates, 79-80. The Reagan presidency was really the springboard to our current political, economic, and cultural era. And it was a transformative presidency. And I think by understanding, the life and presidency of Ronald Reagan, we understand how a transformative president creates far more than policy, but also really creates myths. It was the myth of Reagan that always captivated me. It was Reagan the tax cutter, Reagan the deficit hawk, Reagan the reluctant candidate, Reagan the ordinary citizen, Reagan the hero an assassin's bullet could not kill. And the way that myth was embraced by the GOP for the last four decades, I always felt compelling. And I always felt that they were really stuck in the past. And that really led to my interest to explore the life of Reagan, why he was such a captivating figure for the GOP, and why, in many ways, the myth of Reagan has held the GOP hostage for the last four decades, which I think ultimately led to really the takeover of that party by Trump, because the GOP, being stuck in the myth of Reagan, lacked any vitality or new vision.
Or as times progressed, they didn't have the, okay, what's next? It's almost like at the end, I hope I'm not ruining a movie from 1972, but at the end of Robert Redford's movie, The Candidate, where this underdog wins and they're sitting down after he takes his victory speech, and the Redford looks at the room and goes, okay, now what do we do?
Well, really well said, because as we say in the book, in 1980, 1981, tax cuts weren't a bad idea. Deregulation wasn't a bad idea. Fortifying the military wasn't a bad idea. Again, all planks of the Reagan administration, which, again, at that time, not bad policy. But as you point out, Chris, the GOP has never really deviated from that policy, despite, the rise of China, despite the end of the Soviet Union, despite global warming. They haven't modified or adapted or grown within that body, within the GOP. They're just playing the Gipper's golden oldies, if you will.
So as far as taxes are concerned, for you listening, we keep an eye on what is presented, and hopefully those who present it will hold to it if and when they win either re-election or election. And as far as Ronald Reagan is concerned, what Ed Oswald does with From Ronald to Donald, How the Myth of Reagan Became the Cult of Trump, with Reagan's and everything concerning Reagan, you might be asking what's, and Ed gives you the how and the why behind those what's. It's an interesting read for both a fan and a non-fan of Ronald Reagan. It does help you understand, too, the elements of that life and that work that transformed and became a catalyst for a lot of what we see in the here and now. EdwinGOswald.com, Mr. Oswald's website. Ed Oswald, Thank you so much for helping us gain understanding. And that's always a good thing, because that's the empowerment that we as voters need to have for all issues, not just taxes. Thanks for being here today.
Chris, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.